Bad news, gang. We've gone into One Piece. This is one of 200 filler episodes. Welcome back to Motorsport 101. If nothing else, we can confirm the One Piece is real. Hi, welcome to episode 676 of Motorsport 101, almost as many episodes as One Piece at this point. I'm your friendly neighborhood host, Dre Harrison. Glad you could join us. Hope you guys are enjoying the summer breaks that we're now currently in. Well, mostly, MotoGP's is about to come to an end. They're getting going again this weekend for the British Grand Prix. But as you may have noticed, none of our major series had a race this weekend. No Formula One, they're now on their summer break. No MotoGP, they're coming towards the end of theirs. And no IndyCar, they took an extra week off before they're back at Portland this weekend. So consider this a filler episode where we catch up on some of the big pieces of news you may have missed or just wanted us to talk about in the interim between now and the proper racing getting going again. Joining me, who's just come back from a, shall we say, eventful weekend at IMSA at Road America, it's Mr. Rory James O'Connell. Hello, RJ. How's it going?
I was about to say, and I don't want to be that guy that's like, man, F1's off, MotoGP's off. Man, there must be no race. I'm like, actually. But for me personally, because it's my job, I was very busy with the racing this weekend. I don't know about you, but I was quite busy.
Yeah, you were quite busy. You had Road America to deal with, and I assume you were probably up at some funky time to watch Super GT's return to Fuji Speedway. And for lack of a better term, Igor Fraga taking flight.
That's right. During the Super GT race on Sunday, small spoilers for those of you who are going to inevitably watch the replay that goes up on the series YouTube channel sometime later this week. Igor Fraga, who is now a GT500 driver for Honda, had one of the worst-looking accidents you'll see in a while. Thankfully, it was okay. He's already been released from the hospital after going there the night of the race for further checks, and he might race this weekend because Super Formula is on this weekend. He gets swept up in a three-car accident. Two of the factory Nissans hit each other. One of them turns Fraga around, and he blows over NASCAR style along the front straightaway before landing left side, driver's side, on the pavement. And if you go back and watch, you realize he's not far from hitting the overhead gantries where they do the timer and the lap counter and all that. That could have been much worse.
Oh, gotcha. That was hellacious. Bertrand Baguette had to hit up social media and profusely apologize for not giving Fraga room. I believe he was given, a stop and hold for 90 seconds and then a drive-through on top of that for his role in that incident.
Yeah, at least a stop and go plus 90. And if you work that out, 90 seconds is about a lap in a GT500 car around Fuji Speedway. Mm-hmm. So he was basically parked for a lap. Fraga said after coming out of it, looking back, if the car had been launched even slightly differently in terms of position or angle, the outcome could have been entirely different. And that is why I strongly feel it is important to simply not to simply conclude that it was okay this time, but to use this experience to improve safety in the future, because I believe there's still room for improvement in safety measures so that we can build an environment where everyone involved in motorsport can enjoy the sport with peace of mind. I sincerely hope that this incident will serve as a catalyst for further improvements in safety. Bear in mind, this is the second time we've had a blowover crash in GT500 because 3 years ago, Sugio Matsuda, Nissan racing legend, had the same thing happen to him, and he hit the catch fence at the very end of 130R at Suzuka.
Yeah, terrifying crash. Jeez, that was horrible. Relatively okay in the end, but God, that was a scary, scary one to see in real time, certainly. So,
absolutely. Yeah,
not ideal. I mean, I don't know GT500 as well as you. Like, is it like Formula One star where it's like ground effect flooring? Is that why these cars are flying up into the air when they're knocked off the equilibrium, when they're getting hit at that kind of speed? Is that it?
it's not so much ground effect cars, but I'll tell you, these things do make a lot of downforce. Like, you think a contemporary hypercar is quick, and it is, but the sheer amount of downforce makes GT500 the fastest active class of cars anywhere in the world of multi-class sports car racing. Over the last 10 years, only the hybrid LMP1s were quicker around Fuji Speedway. That's your barometer.
I remember I've driven some of those cars in Gran Turismo 7, and yeah, that's the one thing that jumped out to me was the amount of downforce they have is crazy. The cornering speeds they're coming around on. And Fuji's like a short track, I get that, but it's a fast one. And yeah, you feel every inch of that downforce when you're going around it in those sorts of machines. So yeah, that was wild. And then on top of that, you were in Wisconsin for IMSA's now 6 hours of Road America. It was a 2 hour 40 sprint race. It's now a full-blown 6 hour affair, and it seemingly went viral for all the wrong reasons in that sense, because it was a bit of a messy finish.
It didn't start as such, and it wasn't trending to be as such, right? The first hour of the race had some mess, but that's typical. Some amateur drivers going way above their depth at the start of a race because they want to try and gain as much position. Whatever, that's fine. I've seen that dozens of times. The race settles down, and then the last 2 hours happen, and it all kicks off with a collision up at turn 6 between Jack Aitken and Felipe Nasr, which Nasr gets punted off into the gravel.
Oh, that one Nasr too.
That one, in a vacuum, it wouldn't be so controversial if it wasn't for the fact that it was rolled no further action. Everybody watching in real time felt like Aitken was at least in some way responsible. I know there's the angle of like Nasr forced Aitken off the track. There's a broadcast camera shot where it looks like Aitken just kind of dips two wheels into the grass himself, but they collide at the apex of turn 6. Nasr gets spun around, and as a result, we have a full course yellow and a no further action taken on that incident. That's the second time the car 31 has been involved in a 50-50 collision and not received a penalty that some people felt it probably should have gotten. Then Nasr and Louis Delatraz, for that matter, come speeding up to a zone where track workers are trying to repair a patch of the runoff. Both of them get parked for 60 seconds. That's a 60-second stop-and-go penalty, and I can't say that's not undeserved. Miraculously, Delatraz and Jordan Taylor came back to finish third because the rest of the last 2 hours was ultimate chaos, and the lasting image of that will be Kevin Estra pretty much edging Jack Aitken off of the road and both of them crashing into turn 1 with 10 minutes to go. That's the end of Aitken and Cadillac Whelan's podium streak that dated back to Indianapolis last year. And really just emblematic of a race that this event rules, by the way. I will say that.
And
Road America is an ideal event where if you're going to have a fifth IMSA endurance round in the calendar, it should not be at Indianapolis Motor Speedway, where, don't get me wrong, the venue itself is legendary, but the road course itself is not as inspiring. Now, let's be real, anything short of an Indianapolis 500 crowd is going to look empty. And that's been the problem, and it's not just IMSA and the IGTC Indy 8-hour that's had this problem. Right.
We just had NASCAR there last week for the Brickyard 400, which, you know, it was Heim time again in that instance. And they sold 68,000 tickets, which was a lot for a NASCAR race under any circumstances. 68 grand is a great turnout. But when you seat 250, technically it's only a quarter full. So it looks terrible on TV, but you've still sold a boatload of tickets. It's a good problem to have. You know?
Yeah, exactly. Fortunately, Road America was packed, and I know maybe they can't fit in a quarter of a million to 350,000 people in the venue, but I can tell you on hand that that event, this week's IMSA race, outdrew the last two IndyCar races at the same venue. And we all know that IndyCar people love Road America, but this, I think growing this race out to a 6-hour endurance event really has brought in even more people. Like my editor, Stephen Kilby, who made the trip all the way from his home in London, the UK, to watch this for the first time. And he freaking loves this place. I agree. I love the event. I just think that this race got a bit too extra in the final 2 hours. And the frustrating thing for me was that they were calling penalties early on in the race, blocking penalties, avoidable contact penalties. And I was thinking to myself, it's a bit stingy, but I can understand after last year's race, which was also a mess, if we're going to call this tight, if we're going to be less lenient on incidental contact and blocking, I have no problem with that as long as it's consistent. And it wasn't just the Aitken and Nasr crash, which everybody is upset about, that aggravated me. It was just more of the matter of, like, there was an incident, not even a few minutes later, between one of the factory Fords and one of the factory Corvettes and GTD Pro that looked a lot more careless. No further action was ruled there. There were blocking penalties that I felt were a bit over the top. There were also collision penalties, incident responsibility penalties, where I've watched the onboards of some of these cars and thinking, where's the penalty? It didn't even look like there was contact from the onboard. It was not a weekend where certainly the drivers didn't cover themselves in glory. Kevin Estra, I think, and I say this with all due respect, Kevin Estra drove like the last 90 minutes. He had heard that there was no further action on the 31. It's like, you know what? I'm out here to get street justice. And it ultimately culminated in that collision. Estra was making some pretty aggressive moves to try and get in front of and stay in front of the 31 car. Aitken also probably, he wasn't inculpable himself, because I don't think he should have been going for an outside move for second place with 10 minutes to go, knowing that he's leading the championship by a significant margin. There was
possibility. It's not even that. I would say going around the outside of turn one is a very low percentage move at Road America.
Absolutely. Felipe Albuquerque
just get pushed out. Yeah.
Ironically, Felipe Albuquerque making that move around Jack Aitken on a restart was what won Wayne Taylor Racing the race. By the way, Wayne Taylor Racing finally snapped its 2-year winless drought as the only car, the number 10 car of Albuquerque and Ricky Taylor, that drove a penalty-free race in the GTP class.
Yeah, just this, I fully agree with you, RJ, that I think inconsistent stewarding was the main culprit here. The track itself is not the problem. It's a great facility. The turnout was fantastic. It's a great event in theory. I just think, one, the driving standards were very sketchy from people who should know better. And I do fully agree in that I think Kevin Estra took that final clash as a citizen's arrest. The general notion I've seen on social media was Estra's got to sit one out for that, but the 31's been asking for it for some time.
I don't know if they're going to park Estra for a race, because they're still, like, after the race, they said there may be further investigations. I don't think either of them sit. It's not good for the show. But the reality is,
it's worth saying, by the way, this race result is still not official, because they're still investigating this.
Right. They're still investigating it. I'm not expecting much to come from it. I expect fines. I could expect some cars and some teams and some drivers to get dock points. I'm not expecting a one race suspension. That's a lot more to get part for one race in IMSA than it is for NASCAR. But overall, it just needs to be better. And this is one of the things I was worried about going into 2026, where we had the messy race of Road America last year. Then obviously IMSA decided, you know what? This is our come to Jesus moment. We've got to tighten things up. And so at VIR and Indy, Road Atlanta, and Petit Le Mans, they were much tighter, almost too tight. So going into 2026, I'm thinking, are we loosening things up? And at Watkins Glen and at Road America, I feel like we've had two races in a row where we are at great venues, and obviously a lot is happening. This race still brought a lot of great storylines to the fore, but some of the storylines I feel are colored with the fact that these are some of the best sports car endurance racing drivers in the world, and they just haven't driven like it, by and large.
I want to. I think Joey Barnes, who does great work for the Motorsport Network and IndyCar and IMSA as well, reported there were 9 cautions in a 6-hour race and 48 penalties.
That's 48. The cautions added up to 2 hours and 24 minutes. I know with this being a long track, it brought back the discussion. Do we need full course yellows, virtual safety cars, et cetera, at IMSA? I was talking about this with Kilby, and he put forth the idea that IMSA races would be better with the World Endurance Championships rule set, where obviously they take a much harsher stance on track limits, avoidable contact. They have full course yellows. They don't do all the safety car wave arounds, right? And conversely, WEX racing would be better if it run by IMSA rules, where you do have more sprint starts, safety car restarts, et cetera, to liven up what sometimes are dull races for the most part.
It's not a bad theory. I could certainly see the logic behind it, where maybe a bit more clamping needs to be done on IMSA's end for their current set of driving standards, and maybe WEC needs loosening up a little bit, because I've watched WEC this year. I've watched every race of WEC this year. I can't say I've massively enjoyed it, if I'm being completely honest. And
this race had more safety cars in one race, I think, WEC has had all of last season, which, don't get me wrong, like, I don't mind that there's not an abundance of safety car interventions.
It happens. It's racing. I mean, they're going to have days like that where you have no choice but to safety car the field. And Road America's not the biggest track in the world. Some of its runoffs are quite short. You sometimes you just got no choice in the matter. And it's one of them racing deals, as Cam would say.
Yeah, exactly. On this there's show. Only so, maybe one you know, incident that there's only one or two incidents where I feel like this would have been better if there was a virtual safety car to retrieve this, because a lot of the incidents for some of the single car accidents, they're at fast corners and they are not easy, easy hits. Like, tell you what, Sheena Monk in GTD, her Ford Mustang crashes up against the wall in the kink. I wouldn't just throw a virtual safety car for that. Same with a couple of the hits. Conor DeFilippi up in GTD Pro. Tom Blomqvist had a big one at the end in GTP, yeah, which obviously went overshadowed because of what happened immediately after on the following restart.
Yeah.
Lauren Heinrich at JDC Miller Motorsports, they took 3 penalties and a mechanical black flag and still ended up finishing second. While Heinrich recalls having so much pressure building up at the cockpit that caused the door to unlatch.
Yeah.
It wasn't quite Ocean Gate, but I feel like a lot of drivers had very Ocean Gate-like races.
Yes, and thankfully their cars were not controlled by a 20-pound Logitech bootleg controller. If you want to see the highlights of that race, IMSA are very good with their YouTube highlights. The full 40-minute highlight reel version is up on their YouTube channel. I believe the full replay will be up later on in the week, knowing how IMSA get down. So if you want to see that race, the 40-minute highlight should be more than enough, quite frankly, on YouTube. If not, the whole thing will be up very shortly, probably by the time this goes out, actually. So, yeah, that's that. As it goes, actually, tell you, Rory in our chat has just told us full replay is already up. So there you go. The whole race is up if you want to watch it.
It's free for one more thing before we move on for that. One more thing before we move on for sports car general. I know the Fraga wreck was bad, but Honda did get its first win with the Prelude GT at GT500. Congrats to AlphaTauri legend Naoki Yamamoto and F2 feature race winner Tadasuke Makino and Stanley Team Kunimitsu for bringing home the W. And also congratulations to everybody at Pfaff Motorsport for getting the win at GTD Pro, their first in 3 years. Sadly, 24 hours later, the worst-kept secret in the paddock for a variety of reasons, the team is announcing that they are going to stop racing at IMSA at the end of the year. Team owner Chris Pfaff has put a lot of money in that project, but ultimately, now that he is part of the new ownership group at Mosport, which currently is known as Canadian Tire Motorsports Park, he wants to focus on that and try and improve that as a venue and really build it up over the years. And ultimately, racing at any level is not a cheap sport. Nope. And Chris just felt like it was time to close this chapter of his motorsports involvement, which is a shame. Bat Motorsports has a championship-winning, race-winning organization. They've won the 24 Hours of Daytona. They've given Lamborghini, I think, the first legitimate win with the Temerara GT3. Because the thing is, right, it's already won in DTM, but we mm-hmm. know the teething pains that the car has had. They've had to give the car extra downforce, more than it's supposed to run, to make it competitive over in the former German Touring Car Championship. But in IMSA, the car runs within the window that it's meant to. And on that day, they were, again, clean in a race where not a lot of other people were around them, and it paid off for them. And also, they weren't necessarily slow all weekend, I can tell you that much.
Indeed. We're already in a situation where after a break-in update, the Temerario is no longer the mockery of GT3 racing. It's no longer such a pig that, it's going to be the laughing stock of that field. It is now competitive. It is now winning. And I'm sure these fields will balance out to make it a bit harder for the Temerario going forward. But the point is, it is now competitive and it can now run with the much more established GT3s it's around. And they've turned that around in less than a year. That's good work, and they deserve praise for getting it up to that position. Right, so we had two major stories to do. We'll do the social media stuff at the end of the episode rather than that, because we've already done 25 minutes on this. About 22, 23 minutes, something like that. But there were two major stories during the last week that we think were worth addressing in full on this show. The first one's coming up now, IndyCar. And after years of speculation, many arguments, and political rubbernecking, as far as the eye could see, we saw it in the flesh. We've seen it on a track. We've seen it in the rain, even. IndyCar finally now has its brand new car up and working. The IR28 made its public debut this week at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We had the Alexes down in force to help test it, Alex Rossi and Alex Palou. And here's some of the key specs you may have missed. The IR28 will be £100 lighter than its current predecessor. The hybrid's going to be £20 lighter as part of that, as well as the gearbox apparently being £25 lighter, as well as better weight distribution than for the car in general. They're going to be powered by a brand new 2.4-litre twin-turbocharged V6 that produces 760 horsepower up on the old car, with a hybrid unit that now holds 14 times more energy than the previous one, meaning hybrid will likely play a much greater role in terms of in-race and in-qualifying deployment. There will also be spec dampers across the entire field, one of the very few things on an IndyCar that you can actually tweak in terms of setup. There'll be spec dampers going forward, but there'll be a greater range of damper settings to select for teams beforehand. So there'll be different specs of dampers that are going to be eligible to be used in this new car. But once they're in, they're in. So yes, that is the long and the short of the new car. There's also, and of course, any new car is going to get people talking, RJ. That's inevitable. What have you made of it now we've actually seen it on track and in the flesh?
Well, the first thing I want to say is that aesthetically, I think it's all right. I was not expecting it to be a drastic departure from what we've already had. I'd say it looks a bit more European single-seater influenced than anything, yes. But the lines and the shape of it, it's still, at least in road and street course form, this still looks familiar in a good way. And that's not necessarily a bad thing, I don't think.
No, I think someone left the homework page on the F1 2022 cars a little bit. I think it's given a little bit of F1 2022. I think it's given a little bit of Super Formula's current spec car as well. So, yes, I think it looks a little bit more like that. I'm not the biggest fan of the curves on the front and the rear wings, but overall, I think it's fine. I don't think there's anything.
Ultimately, with this car, it's a matter of what does it do functionally? Because as we know, the IR18 in its current configuration with the aero screen, with the current hybrid system, feels like a patch job, right? We know the width distribution is a bit naff. We know the road and straight course product has not been as good in recent years. So we're all just wondering, how is it going to perform? How is it going to drive? We're not going to know what it's like in race trim for another year plus, but I did find this fascinating from Alex Palou's test in the car, because we all want to make sure that Alex Palou, the best driver in the series, gets his hands on the car early to see what it's like. I'm going to sign from everybody else. But this is from Mike O'Gara. He is the vice president of competition of race engineering for IndyCar. He said that while we were doing stuff on damper adjustments that Alex Palou liked, in the end, he set a fast lap today of 1 minute 10.5, which was not too shabby considering he wasn't even pushing that hard. Now, for reference, his quick lap in practice one for the Indy Grand Prix this year was a 1:10.2, and his quick lap of the race was a 1:12.1. So he feels that if Palou pushes and is also on maybe a softer compound tire, you will likely see, and Palou agrees as well, that track records will fall, especially on the road and street courses, once this thing is up and running.
Yeah, I reckon there's just going to be at least a second and a half a lap faster on most places. And that's a lot, given that most of IndyCar's road and street courses are very short, like less than 70-second laps for the most part. There's a lot of their road and street courses they do race on are on the smaller side, besides Arlington and Road America, really. So, yeah, I think that's certainly a thing. I mean, they made it very clear in the promo material. They want to break the Indianapolis track record for the 500 as well. They made that abundantly clear. Now, this test was in the road and street course package in terms of aero trim, so not an oval test per se. And even if it was, we wouldn't have been able to run it because it was raining during the course of the test, so no dice there. But they mentioned that, and I don't think that was unintentional. There was a big promo video that James Hinchcliffe narrated where he talks a lot about one of the main aims is to break the Indianapolis track record. Harry Leyendyke was directly referenced in that. And, well, if that's the case, we're going to be looking at, you know, higher end of 240 miles an hour. So that's going to be fun.
Had Matt Damon do narrations for the launch of this car. That's crazy.
That's a lot of money. Like that I don't think Matt would have done that for cheap. Like they were big on this. I mean, and this, the thing is, this came relatively out of nowhere. There was some rumblings a couple of weeks ago that they might unveil this car soon, but with us being cynical about the previous Dallara DW12s, almost like Sega CD32X existence at this point, we've been quite cynical about this car. Is it ever going to actually happen? Are they going to keep kicking this can down the road? If nothing else, I'm just glad we can actually see it in the flesh more than anything else. And earlier than I thought it was going to as well.
Yeah, I think the ramp up for when the DW12 launched would have had to be at least a year of testing. And I know the late, great Dan Weldon was part of the test driver committee when that car was being put through its paces in 2011, because let's remember, Dan Weldon was a part-time driver back then, won the Indianapolis 500 out of it all. Ed brings up a great point. Taller drivers, of which there are many, what's up, Graham Rahal, they're not going to be as close to the ground now when they sit, which should reduce the likelihood of somebody hurting their back in case of extreme bottoming out or a wreck. It, as Ghost Raptor points out, is a lot more put together than we all expected it to be. Again, I think the aesthetics is kind of like, for me, it's like I wasn't expecting a radical departure, but I think we can all agree, like, at the end of the day, as long as it makes the racing product better, I think this car will be a success, and I'm really fascinated to see how this all plays out. One last thing. this is not going to be, this is not the car that is going to bring about the end of Alex Palou being an elite IndyCar driver.
No. People are so anti Palou because it's like, I get it. Palou is a generational talent in a series that is deliberately designed for you not to have a dominant force. If anything, as Raptor points out, I agree. I think this is going to be a better fit for someone like Alex Palou, who has raced similar aero-packaged cars like the Super Formula car that he raced before he got to IndyCar in the first place. So if anything, I actually think this could be a good fit for Palou more than anything else when it comes to his skill set.
The only thing that will really throw people off is the damper packages, right? Because all these teams have their own in-spec damper packages, and that's going out the window Cup 2028.
Indeed. I don't disagree with what you're saying, RJ. I think the thing with, and I'm taking a page out of F1's 2022 season when they had their last major regulation set before this one, a lot of the aesthetic talk went away very quickly when we found out that the 2022 cars actually could follow each other and actually race each other reasonably well. Like, I remember that season, and I remember that there was a lot of goodwill towards F1 in 2022 because the new car was great. What ruined it was the FIA was unable to curb the inevitable engineers doing what engineers are designed to do, right, and that is add more topside downforce, add more aero wash, and that's what led us going back down to the cars that we now know and more associate with 2026 now. I mean, look, the battery is a failsafe for the fact that these cars can't follow each other. The battery is actually more of a compensation. Just don't tell the hardcores that. But it's, for me, there's a lot riding on this for IndyCar because this Frankenstein's monster of what their current car is needs to be moved on now. And the racing for IndyCar is not in the best of places. The ovals, I think, have still been largely fine, to, you know, good to very good. The ovals are still the highlight of IndyCar right now, and they've been largely excellent this season. The road and street course racing has not been great, and it hasn't been great for a couple of years now. I think it's been pretty mediocre. The fact that the series has had to change the rules on tires, on what tires to use, they've had to ditch their recyclable compound because it, like, the tire wear was off the charts with the hybrid and the extra weight on the car. I think it's genuinely caused more problems than it's solved in the series on a road and street course level. So there is a lot riding on this IR28 to fix and address a lot of those issues. They think it will. The proof of the pudding will be in the eating. I want it to do well because I very much enjoy IndyCar road and street course races. I think there's a tactical element of them, and I think at its best, these cars are more raceable than what Formula One is right now. But right now, it's much of a muchness when you compare the two series and how they race on tracks that turn left and right. So for me, I think it's promising. But I look forward to seeing how they race in 2028 when that time comes. It's going to be a long year and change before we get to that point. But we shall see.
At least along the way, we are getting another Phoenix Raceway doubleheader. That's been announced. That's nice. The IndyCar race will be on Saturday, March 13th. It'll be the Saturday before the NASCAR Cup Series race at the same venue. Pretty successful event the first time they did it. Curious to see how year two plays out, because remember, it's one thing to introduce or reintroduce a short oval to the IndyCar calendar in the first year successful. It's keeping that momentum going to years 2, 3, 5, etc. That has really proven to be the problem for some places. Gateway's been fine. We don't talk about Iowa.
Yeah,
I miss Iowa.
I miss Iowa, but yeah, I wonder why Captain Newgarden over there. It's one of those ones where Iowa's lack of promotion ultimately killed them off. Look, I'm still not 100% sure what these doubleheaders are doing for IndyCar in the grand scheme of things. Is anybody going to these doubleheaders for IndyCar that wasn't already going to Phoenix anyway? I wonder. It's like, It feels like it's more a perk for a NASCAR fan that's going to that weekend. It's like, oh, we get IndyCars on Saturday too. That's great. And then, so, you know, I still wonder how much of this doubleheader is actually benefiting IndyCar, but they're going to have a doubleheader in St. Pete with the trucks, and they're now going to have another one in Phoenix. It generally did well, so why not? So let's see how we go. For those who are keeping tabs on things, it looks like IndyCar are drip feeding the 2027 calendar as we go. Uncle Bob Pockris, as I like to nickname him, has already labeled the key dates already. It looks like we're starting the season with a triple header. Yay. But it's March 7th in St. Pete. That was confirmed last week. March 14th weekend for Phoenix. Arlington the week after that on March 21st. Again, seemingly just the one race in April with Long Beach there on the 18th. The 500 will be on May 30th. And then again, traditionally, Detroit will be the week after on my mum's birthday. I was actually not my mum's birthday, my dad's birthday, June the 6th. We have seemingly the first six dates of the season set in stone because of other announcements and IMSA doubleheaders and bookings already unveiled. So it looks like we've already got at least the first third of IndyCar's 27 calendar out already.
Yeah. We got another story to talk about, Dre, and this one from the world of MotoGP. We talked about this before we went on break. Maverick Vinales' future with KTM Tech 3 Racing. Now, he's already been declared out of the British Grand Prix this weekend because he suffered from another complication from his recent shoulder surgery. But this one follows up the strong reports from across the biking world that we talked about earlier that Tech 3 may be looking to terminate Vinales' deal early and replace him with KTM development rider Pol Espargaró. Now, Vinales will have heard the rumors, and he has heard them, and he has addressed them by saying the following, quote, "I start to read articles without sense. Last week, I've been in the APC center, and we start to understand why I'm not able to recover. I'm contrasting all this information with my doctors to check if this is the problem and what is the way to improve. Stop writing stupid articles about me. I will not race in World Superbike, and I will finish the year as my contract says." End quote. So it seems as if Maverick Vinales is not done just yet. He's not racing this weekend, but if he is to be believed, he will at least finish out the end of the season, Dre.
It's an interesting one because, I mean, morale was real low coming off the German Grand Prix, the last round we had before the break. He'd already gotten into a public war of words with the man who, you know, sees a fire and pours gasoline on it, and that's Günther Steiner, where he was like, if I'm not on the MotoGP grid next year, you can blame KTM. And Günther Steiner clapped back and said, well, that wasn't very bright of you now, was it? The problem we've got here is that, let's be frank, Maverick Vinales has made a career of, shall we say, burning bridges with teams when shit has hit the fan.
Yeah.
There's a rap sheet with Maverick. You know, there's his days with Avintia when he was in Moto 3, when he quit the team with three rounds to go because he claimed the team was second rate and that he, felt like he wasn't given the tools to be able to challenge for the title. He came back, but then he quit at the end of the year anyway. He went to Team Calvo, and then he won his Moto 3 title there. That great Moto 3 title battle with him, Alex Rins, and the late Louis Salom. God, it's been 10 years. I miss Louis Salom so much. By the time he got to MotoGP, he was deemed to be like the Marquez stopper. You're like the anti-Marquez. You're the next great Spanish talent to come along and potentially disrupt the main event scene. And it started out great at Yamaha. Won three out of his first five there after a successful tenure at Suzuki. Won their first race when they came back to the MotoGP grid, ironically, at Silverstone. He blew up his bike. He over-revved his bike on purpose. When he fell out with Yamaha, he fell out with his crew chief Ramon Forcada. He didn't want to copy Fabio Quartararo's setup when he started winning MotoGP races at the top flight for Yamaha as Rossi's replacement. Was fired from Yamaha, went to Aprilia, won a race there, quit the team because he couldn't replicate what he did at COTA that one time, as we called him Batmav, when he won at Austin from 12th on the grid. You know, he's now gone to KTM. Was going great at KTM. Like last year, he was matching Pedro Acosta stride for stride. He was the vocal point of KTM's development. And then the shoulder crash. Then the shoulder injury happens. He busts his shoulder. And he's not been the same rider since. He's been on and off the track for the last calendar year now, effectively. His shoulder still hasn't fully recovered. He actually broke a chunk of it off when he had the accident. He was in recovery. He sat out the rest of the year early. He was looking like he was getting back to 100%. Then he crashed in preseason. That broke screws in the plate that he had put in. Had to get a second surgery to get that fixed. And now this latest development is that he's torn another muscle in his shoulder that they didn't initially find. So that might be part of the reason why he struggled so much up until this recent summer break. Look, you can't throw your team under the bus publicly. And the thing is, right, Maverick's got a point in that KTM also has a bad reputation of mistreating its riders. This is not an isolated incident. For those who don't know, Pit Bearer admitted at the German Grand Prix that they'd lowballed Maverick. They gave him a very low financial offer to try and keep him for cheap because they wanted to see what Maverick could do when he was 100% healthy. So they were kicking the contract extension down the road because Maverick didn't want to sign for cheap. And Maverick's run out of patience because now most of the grid is confirmed for next year. Most of the grids had deals in place for 6 months already. And now Maverick's been unable to negotiate with any other team since then. And Maverick's lost his rag and then lashed out at KTM from a press standpoint. And I think that's like, it's very reminiscent of what KTM did with Johann Zarco. Because Johann Zarco went to KTM once upon a time. I think it was 2019 he went to KTM. And when Zarco started dissing the bike publicly, KTM doesn't tolerate it when you criticize the brand in public. They are very bitchy about that. Like Jason the chat says, ask Raul Fernandez, ask Remy Gardner. Let's not forget, it was Remy's father, quite famous dad, Wayne Gardner, who called KTM's boss a clown on Twitter. And his son was fired at the end of the season. Raul Fernandez
I don't
never
think it
wanted
would have
to be
achieved
there.
The same level that Wayne did. But, you know, 1 year and done feels very harsh for Remy Gardner.
It was. The whole story there was KTM brought up both their Moto2 riders that year. That was the greatest Moto2 team ever assembled. Remy Gardner and Raul Fernandez, they dominated the championship. They won the team's title in August that year. I think it was like 12 or 13 wins between them as a team. They just bumped them both up into Tech 3. Raul Fernandez didn't want to be there because Yamaha tried to buy him out of his contract, and then Raul was pissy that he didn't let him go. And Remy Gardner's dad threw the team under the bus on Twitter. They were both let go after 1 year. They were one and done. Raul went to Trackhouse, where he's now confirmed to be there till 2028. That's news that broke through yesterday, by the way. Gardner was never seen in MotoGP again. He now rides for Yamaha in World Superbikes. Kieran in the chat says, I wonder if looking back, Raul is happy the Yamaha buyout didn't happen. You're probably right in hindsight, but hindsight's a wonderful thing, isn't it? But KTM.
Nobody comes off well in this, I think it's fair to say, because you have a rider who is known to agitate, and you have a team that is known to mill through its riders like crazy.
Yes. KTM do not treat their riders well. We have more than enough proof of that from Fernandez, Gardner, Danilo Petrucci, Ikela Kuona. They've been rough with how they've handled their riders in the past. We've not even talked about that. The Brad Binder is gone. He's going to BMW's World Superbike team next year to replace Petrucci, another man who was probably treated quite harshly by KTM at the time. But at the same time, Maverick has history, and he's not learned his lesson that you can't you can't diss the team and the people in it publicly. You can't do it. Yeah. They're going to kill you for that there.
Pedro Acosta, as others point out, is like, he has been frustrated. Obviously, he's not won a race at KTM, and we know he's moving on, but he's blamed the bike and not the team and the personnel, and that's the difference. It's got to be interesting being part of KTM's public relations department, Dre.
I made a video talking about Maverick's history in the KTM blow-up, and that same day, I had it pop up on my LinkedIn page that KTM was looking for a freelance PR manager. I promise you I'm not making this up. It's hilarious.
The benefits better be generous there if I'm going to be working 120 hours plus overtime to help write this ship.
Yeah, and look, I know people have mentioned Acosta here. What I would say is your leash is a lot longer when you're Pedro Acosta and you're the nearest thing that team has had to a win in half a decade. Because they've not won a race since Miguel Oliveira was there in 2023. It's been 3 years.
Another man who you could probably make an argument, I don't know if it's a winning one, that KTM did not do right by him on the way out.
And like, they've had great talent pass through that team. Many multiple MotoGP race winners they've put through that team. World champions in their own right in other classes and other races. I would say Pedro, okay. Again, Pedro Acosta is very bitchy in his own right. He's very forthright with the media. He has criticized the team and bike, but it's Pedro Acosta. Are you cutting him early? Of course not. No. He's the face of your team.
You're despondent, and he's already made this up his mind that he's going to go race in red next year.
And I was going to say as well, isn't it funny that when it was announced that Acosta was going to Ducati, KTM didn't even acknowledge it or even give him a thank you on social media?
Oh, jeez.
Well, when Alex Marquez left Gresini, you got this beautiful Orange is the New Black parody poster on Gresini's socials. It was a heartfelt message from Nadia Panavani, who runs the team, about how much you've grown as a rider, grown as a man, and how much we love you and we're grateful for you. KTM didn't post a fucking thing. Like, it's very bitchy, because Pedro's done a lot for that team, and he's been their best rider by a country mile for the last 3 years he's been there, and they didn't even acknowledge it. Good luck, Alex and Fabio, next year. You're going to need it, although we've also got the Tech 3 situation. It looks like it's going to be Luca Marini and Senna Aegis next year. It looks like Senna Aegis has beaten Manu Gonzalez to the other seat. That'll be interesting. Someone free Manu Gonzalez. I will say this publicly on the record, because
he's already being free to a superbikes ride.
It's looking like he apparently might get the Ducati seat, the one that that Nicolò Budig is going to leave behind to be alongside Ikea Kuona, which apparently it's between Gonzalez and Frankie Morbidelli. Hire Manu, for the love of God. Hire Manu Gonzalez. He's damn good. And he deserves the opportunity. I mean, the guy has got a very good chance of being Moto2 champion at season's end, and one of the better ones in recent years as well. And it would be a travesty if he's not on the MotoGP grid. But at least get him a top-tier superbike seat, where maybe if he's dominant enough, maybe, as we've seen with Toprak and Bulaga, maybe he can get the opportunity. My closing point on Maverick, it wouldn't surprise me if KTM cut bait early. It wouldn't be the first time they've done it.
Yeah.
You know, it wouldn't surprise me at all if that's how it would play out. Pol Espargaró is still, even as a part-timer, has proven he's still more than good enough to be on the grid full-time. If the right situation came about, he's still a very serviceable rider. I think it might just be for the best for all parties if they just let Maverick go. Maverick looks burnt out. He looks frustrated. He looks like a man who is just fed up with his shoulder, fed up with MotoGP, fed up of dealing with the press and dealing with KTM's internal politics. I just think for everybody, I think a clean break would probably just suit everybody at this point, and we can all just move on, you know?
Probably, but do you think Maverick Viñales is going to want to go out like that if he can help it? I mean, it's not likely he's going to go out better, but I don't think this is what he wants his lasting image in MotoGP to be. Who knows at this point? I'm open to lots of surprises.
If it is the end, let's not get it twisted. He's had a great career.
Yeah.
10 MotoGP wins, the only man in the modern era to do it with three different manufacturers. That's some talent. You know, you don't fluke three different manufacturer wins. He very nearly had a fourth at Qatar last year on that KTM. Second over the line that day, but the tire pressure penalty came into play, so that which knocked him down to 14th. But like the talent of Maverick has never been the question. This is a man who beat Nico Tirole in his fourth ever Moto 3 start, back when it was still the 125cc class. You know, Nico Tirole would win that year's championship, and Maverick won on his fourth start as a 16-year-old. Like the kid's a freak. It's a great career, but there'll always be that nagging thought of, well, what if he had a clean break? What if he wasn't such a PR nightmare sometimes? What if he had a bit more patience for a situation at Yamaha? You know, there's, as they say, if some butts were candy and nuts, we'd all have a Merry Christmas. But it's going to be frustrating that his career is... He's still only 31. Let's not forget. Like, he's not even particularly old.
Like, that's in that up sense. There in years, but that's not, like, so far up there in years that you think that there's the only way to go is down.
Yeah, this...
Marquez is 33 this year. He's, like, only a couple years older, and we know what he's doing, and he's been beat up quite a bit as well.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, he's like I said, he's had a great career. I mean, he's done 15 years in bikes, which is it's half his life, which is crazy to even think about. Like, I think he's one of the last people left who raced on what we call the 125cc class, which has been long dead. So, yeah, that goes to show you how long he's been around. But yeah, like
it's him and it's Johann Zarco, and that's it's not much else after that. Brad Binder's on his way out the door.
Brad's gone, but I don't think I think his was fully Moto 3. I think Mark's the only other one who rode a 125cc bike. When he debuted, I want to say in 2010, it was his first year in Grand Prix. But yeah, like it's. It's a small club, and it's getting smaller. It's like Aleix Espargaró, when he hung it up 2 years ago, was the last man of the 800cc era, you know, and it was Mark's now the most experienced man on the grid, which is a weird thing to say, but here we are, because he debuted in 2013, the first year we had the modern-day prototype. So, yeah, it's a lot, to say the least. Before we get out of here, there's a couple other little things I wanted to talk about because F1, for the most part, hasn't had a huge amount of news drop. But it looks like, RJ, we're getting more sprints for next year. the rumblings.
This is always kind of the thing that we've been predicting, is that there will be more sprints, because at the end of the day, if you sell, even if you don't call it a race, it's still structured like a race. It still acts like a race. As much as people don't like it, they will still tune in for a race. So this felt inevitable. I'm curious to know where they end up.
Yeah, Stefano Domenicali did one of his big media debriefs. He usually does 3 or 4 times a year earlier this week, and there was 2 main things to come out of that. Number one, the sprints. It's looking like there's going to be 9, maybe 10 next year. I've already had texts from a couple of the people I know from the paddock are saying, hey, they better up the cost cap then next year. Because I think the big sticking point for the teams is, if there's like an accident or a crash, who takes financial responsibility for that? Because if we're going to be racing more and having more meaningful action, then we don't want the cost cap to impede our development because of repair costs potentially. So we'll see. I think the teams will cave on this one, because it looks like we're going to at least 9 as opposed to 6. I fully agree with you, RJ, in the sense of, and this is something that a lot of people just don't want to accept, more people out there want to watch sprint qualifying over an FP2, and more people will watch a sprint race on Saturday morning over an FP3. Like, as we've got a 5-year sample size now. We've seen it before.
Yeah.
The numbers go up on sprint weekends of Friday and Saturdays, which I believe was the whole point of this in the first place. MotoGP cut off the Band-Aid and immediately went sprints every weekend. And I think their numbers are like 20-25% bigger on Friday and Saturday. It's worked. Yeah. Commercially, it's a no-brainer. Like, it's inevitable that this was going to happen. And I've always said to people, if you don't like it, vote with your remote. People are not prepared to do that. So this is what you get.
People are prepared to vote with their remote to actually tune in and watch it more often and go to the races with their money. At least the general consensus is that's what that's been. MotoGP has already been successful. But again, this is kind of what I expect. Freedom 250 has been extended to 147 laps. Will now actually be 250 miles long. Fascinating. Yay. Anyway,
yeah. The other major one was, and I don't know how much of this is a serious concern or how much of this is, and I'm gonna name
I
names.
Require contests, because I've been out of it all weekend.
Yeah, because during this media debrief, Stefano Domenicali and I believe it was Ed Straw at the race got into a bit of a conversation about why are some of the graphic packages being removed from Formula One right now? Like, mostly the halo during qualifying and race sessions. The graphics you get on the halo that are superimposed, they've largely gone away. They came back for Hungary this weekend, but for a few rounds they've not been around. And the information on batteries and braking, which we got in Australia, that during the opening race, and they've not been back since, basically. Those graphics are now gone, and a lot of people have kicked off at Stefano Domenicali because Stefano basically dismissed the complaint. And I'm going to quickly try and find the quote he came out with, because George Lucas was mentioned. And I think that was quite funny. I'm like, really? Of all people? It got a lot of people's dander up.
So what is this, that George Lucas says that he has a patent to some of these graphic technologies through his work in the film industry, and that Formula One is using this without his permission, and that's why they're getting pulled? Because that's the only thing that comes to mind here.
Yeah, like, the missing battery data, Stefano's response was, and I quote, "No one is interested in how you drive your car. I had an interesting discussion with George Lucas in Hungary, and he was giving me an incredible view on how the new fans are watching F1. They are fascinated on the fact that there is a lot of action. not interested in the angle of throttle or the percentage of brake pressure on how you can overtake a driver. This did not go over well. In fact, from Autosport, my old colleague Stuart Codlin, Codders to his friends, came out with the great response of, "What qualifies George Lucas to preside over whether we see a battery icon or not? I wouldn't be taking storytelling tips from someone who re-edited Star Wars to make Greedo shoot first." So, it didn't go over well. And, like, I'm in two minds about it. And this may be as near as I get to a hot take, which I don't normally come out with a lot of these days. I'm too old and I'm too broken.
Yeah, that was like multiple employers ago, and like,
yeah,
you had an entire day devoted to these.
Yeah, and you know, like I said, it was Ed Straught, the race, that pushed this argument quite hard. I have nothing but respect for the race and their crew. This is not a personal jab at them or anything to do with them. I think this, and this might be a hot take, if you're listening to this show, if you're listening to my TikTok page, for example, that's got 260-odd followers on it, or watching our YouTube channel that's got like 3,000 subscribers, you are probably in the top 0.5% of all hardcore level Formula One fans if you're listening to us. It's not like we're the race. We're not Autosports F1 Network, who gets tens of thousands of listeners every month. I do wonder, is this a case where the empty vessel makes the most noise? Where, because of the online presence of the most concentrated F1 fandom, maybe the most hardcore 100, 150,000 that are on social media, the same 100, 150K to do those Nielsen surveys every couple of years when the Motorsport Network puts them out there and they correlate the data. When it's the same Formula One that now claims it's got 800 million viewers worldwide. Like Ed Straw, for example, in his piece said that Apple fans in America want more data on their race screen. Like, do they? Was there a survey about this that I missed? A part of me wonders, is this just an extreme minority making the most noise? Is the average channel hopper, is the uneducated fan, do they actually care how much battery is being deployed? Or the more cynical tinfoil side of me thinks, what if this is just F1 covering the fact that these cars are fundamentally flawed when it comes to the on-track product? We've talked about it numerous times, about the battery, the deployment, the super clipping, the easing off on certain straights to lift and coast, etc. Is it a mix of both? I genuinely don't know. Like, it's... because I do wonder if this is, like, as Raptor says in the chat, Occam's razor, where the simplest answer is, you know, the most likely to be the correct one. Because I can understand why many hardcore fans have been pissed off with the way some of these cars control. Like, for example, easing off on the straights. It's a bad look for everybody involved. No one tunes in for the pinnacle of technology in Formula One and see cars dropping speed halfway down the camel.
Yeah, the tagline is not pinnacle of technology, it's pinnacle of motorsport.
Mm. And as Kira puts in the chat, it's a mix of both, but also dumbing down a sport feels wrong.
Yeah,
I agree.
I thought about this, and like, we're big American sports people, right? We both watch baseball, right? And mm-hmm. We know that, like, over the last 10 years, there have been newer ways to quantify how good a player is, how hard they're hitting the ball, how hard they're throwing the ball. And with that brought a lot of aesthetic changes to the game that had been mostly patched out. But when mm-hmm. they started to emerge, people really didn't like them.
Yeah.
And so there's been kind of more and more voices about, like, we are going too far with data. We're going too far with analytics. Can't we just get back to the way that sports used to be before all of this nonsense ruined it?
And there will always be a level of pushback.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's you mentioned baseball. Baseball has got one of the oldest fan bases in sport, let alone American sport. Formula One has had an influx of younger fans in the last half decade come through who are probably different in their perspectives compared to people that are more my age and up. You know, we're both in our mid-30s. I'm 34 in 2 weeks' time.
Mind me.
But, you know, it's one of those things. But we're still probably on the younger end for the average F1 fan. There are guys that are in their 40s, 50s, 60s that watch every race weekend and probably hate these cars right now. They probably don't like the fact that the sport is being dumbed down because they're trying to appeal more to the channel flipper or appeal to the uneducated. A lot of people will be the first to point at DTS and say, oh, they're dumbing our sport down because the new DTS fan isn't interested in the cars. They want to shag the drivers, etc., etc. We've heard those misogynistic tropes that have come through on socials in the time that the fandom has changed. And like any F1 fan worth their salt can recognize that. It's not what this was 10 years ago, for better and for worse. So I again, a part of me, like, I'll be real with you. As a 34-year-old, or nearly 34-year-old, F1 viewer of 20 plus years, I don't think I don't think losing the battery information was a deal breaker. I don't think losing the Halo graphics was a deal breaker that had huge impacts on my visual enjoyment of Formula One. It hasn't. If I'm an outlier, then so be it. I will accept that. But me personally, I'm not that bothered. But it seems that a lot of people are. Grunter says people don't like to be talked down to, and this is a way in which you could perceive that. Yep, definitely, by taking away info. I think the issue is that F1's not been subtle about it. F1's not subtle about anything, and even if it was, we would spot it.
It's not the pinnacle of subtlety.
No, and we have people that are pointing out telemetry, that are using F1 TV onboard footage to monetize it on YouTube. You know, we have people that follow this sport on an intense level.
Yeah.
Like, super intense. More than analytics people do in football. Both kinds, you know? So, it's... I'm just not sure that the kickback we're getting on social is an accurate reflection of how people really feel about F1 right now. But I also admit, I also think Formula One is certainly pandering to the masses a little bit more by trying to take the heat off them a little bit by molding their broadcasts so they don't want to reveal how the sausage is made. Is that fair?
Probably. I don't know. I mean, it's, I don't know. We could draw, if we had the time to do it, because I know we'd be going a while for a filler episode, we'd draw efforts like, what if this was like, oh, they're taking away StatCast and baseball, all the radar tracking to, like, you know, they're giving us less of that information because they are, I don't know, deadening the balls so that they travel less far and you get less home runs and less extra base hits, or they don't want to show the spin rate of certain pitches because they may be letting pitchers use more sticky stuff that it's supposedly take away. These are just like hypotheticals of that sort of thing. Like, me personally, when I watch these races and I get, like, all the information, I like having a good deal of information while I'm watching a race that helps me inform myself. If it's not there, so be it, but I don't mind having it up there.
Yeah.
And we're also not normal viewers in a lot of ways.
Yeah, like, we're creating a fucking podcast talking about this damn sport.
We're genetic freaks and we're not normal.
Yes. So I do wonder how much of this is us looking at the mirror and saying, hey, maybe we're not the problem. They are. You go in there and you make it about you. So I don't know how much of that is our mentality as viewers watching this. And, I'm not entirely sure that our reflection is the fairest or necessarily what people want to see. Because like I mentioned it before, even those big surveys that the Motorsport Network releases once every, I think it's every 2 years they put out now, like even that is normally only about 150,000 fans. That's like maybe 0.1% of the entire F1 viewership.
And
it's a pretty hardcore one if you're going to a journalism website and filling out their goddamn survey. Don't get me wrong, more than enough of a sample size, like in any survey. Like, it's still a huge sample size, and I respect it. I just wonder how important we actually are as an audience, as a very, very slim portion of it. You can debate that one in the comments. I think I'm going to probably clip some of this and put it on YouTube, and I can't wait to see what the reaction's going to be. That's going to be funny. We'll see. But, that'll just about do it here on this week's episode. As mentioned, IndyCar in Portland this weekend. Wouldn't it be the same as last year? Lundgaard, Palou, and Power fighting for the win. That could certainly very likely happen. MotoGP is back for the British Grand Prix this weekend. I do also believe it's free to air on Quest this weekend. So UK folks, please watch it. It's free to air. The British Grand Prix is normally a banger across all three classes. Go watch. You have no excuse. Places you can find this real quick, youtube.com/motorsport101, facebook.com/motorsport101, Instagram and TikTok, motorsport101 pod. Good point from Kira as well. Moto 3 race is after MotoGP, not before. The whole race is an hour earlier than usual, 1 p.m. Our website, motorsport101.com. And of course, our Patreon page, patreon.com/motorsport101. $5 gets you early access to all of our content. You can upgrade to the $10 tier to listen to these episodes live as they're being recorded. I've been Dre Harrison. He's been RJ O'Connell at RJ O'Connell at bluesky.social and RJ O'Connell on Twitter, if you're still mad enough to follow us on there. I've been Dre Harrison. Thank you very much for watching and listening, and we'll catch you guys next week for two more episodes. Sayonara.
Later, y'all. We'll be right back.